Hey, Chicago, it's Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a breakdown of the latest local news in and around Chicago. But first, it's almost spooky season. Yes, Halloween is just around the corner. And if you're into that sort of thing, you're getting your costume together. You're planning to attend some parties. Or maybe even a seance. Yeah, well, that's what some Illinoisans will be doing this week when they visit one of the Watsika homes, well known because of a legend that dates back to 1877, based in the town about 80 miles south of the Loop. Two young girls from neighboring families, the Venoms and the Roths, became linked by what some say was a case of spirit possession. Yeah, the spirit of a Roth daughter, who had been dead for 12 years, was said to take over the body of a Venom daughter, and it stayed there for 5 whole months. Now, in this episode of the pod, we'll revisit that haunting tale for our series, What's That Building? And we'll find out what's become of the houses at the center of it all. At the table was Dennis Rodkin, In the Loop's architecture expert, John Whitman Brito, who's the current owner of the Roth House, and Neil Gibbons, who's owner and founder of Graveside Paranormal Haunted Ghost Tours. Let's go back to 1877, when it all began, Dennis. Now, Lurancy Venom, who's known as Rancy, had been suffering from epileptic fits and stomach problems. What else? What were the other clues, and how did her family respond here?
She hears voices up above her when she's in bed. She feels breath on her face while she's sleeping. And this all starts just days after the anniversary of the death of the other girl. Mary Roth died July 5th, 1865. Mm-hmm. And it's really the night of July 5th, 1877, 12 years later, that this starts. The next day she starts talking about it. And then over the course of several months, she's got the voices, she's got breath on her face, she's having fits, and her parents are increasingly worried and want to send her to an asylum, probably the asylum in Peoria, where the other girl had died.
Right. First of all, the timing there, I mean, that can't have been a coincidence. What do you think?
Well, I think the spiritualists involved are pretty sure that it was not a coincidence. So the girl who had died, Mary Roth, the spirit who had died in 1865, had believed that she could communicate with the other dimension. When she was alive, she believed she could communicate with the other dimension. Her parents felt the same way. So no, I think the fact that a lot of this starts around the anniversary of her death is no coincidence.
Yeah, and before we bring the other gentleman in, Dennis, I'm curious how they eventually made that connection between the behavior that Rancy was displaying and that spirit of Mary Roth, who had been dead for so long prior.
You know, when you read the original article that was written about this about a year after it all transpired, and we all have copies of it in front of us right now, there's talk in town. They're going to send their daughter to this asylum. And the other family, the family whose daughter had died after she'd been in that asylum, kind of says, you know, not the greatest idea. But then over time, when the spirit of the dead girl takes over the body of the living girl, the parents, the mother and sister of the dead girl are nearby, and the living girl says, oh, there's my mom, there's my sister.
Mm.
The people who are not actually her family, but are the family of the girl who died 12 years ago.
And so everyone's shocked.
Yeah.
What is going on? So, Neil, I got to bring you in here because given what you do, I imagine this type of thing fascinates you.
Oh, yeah. I've been fascinated by this many years.
What stands out to you about this particular story?
Well, a lot of people, actually, I think it's a little mislabeled, is that people talk about it as the first documented possession in America, okay? Yes, it is a possession. What is actually called a walk-in, okay? A walk-in is where a spirit can inhabit a host as in body, right? It doesn't mean that it has to be a demon or anything like that. Now, we have to understand is that Lurancy Venom, just like Mary Roth, our first girl, was very clairvoyantly inclined, okay? So she had spirits coming in and out of her. She was being hypnotized by Dr. Winchester Stevens at the time, trying to help her out. And spirits are cycling through. Then all of a sudden, Mary Roth makes an appearance spiritually, what is called a walk-in. And what it is it walks into, it's a simple thing, it walks into the host body. And then it goes and identifies itself. And like he was saying, as Dennis was saying, is that notice all the family members in the house. Notice everyone around them. New family secrets and stuff, right? Knew all these things that were going on. This is more of a spiritual miracle. And I understand people want that thing that, hey, I want to talk about a possession because we've seen the movie The Exorcist and this and that.
I mean, when we talk about possession, we think of the demon kind.
Right. A lot of us, when we first start hearing the word possession, well, that goes back to The Exorcist movie. And don't get me wrong, I love movies like that. And I'm not going to knock them. I just watched the new Conjuring movie. I love all those things. But I think some of these things do get mislabeled. Is there something very supernatural going on here? Yes. Supernatural, yes.
Yes.
Anything demonic? No.
No.
But it's still a beautiful thing that over 100 days, you get a spirit of someone who died and then inhabited a host body to help heal her. And supposedly a story goes is that, well documented, that she went off to heaven for that 100 days. And then all of a sudden, after the 100 days, Mary Roth came down. And she presented herself, said, it's time for me to go.
Mm.
And then the rancid venom then came back.
As herself.
And she lived a very long life, moved to California, lived a long life, had a family.
So, John, as the current owner of one of these homes, first of all, did you know all of this before you made that purchase? I'm curious.
I did. I bought the home as an agnostic 20 years ago. I thought, you know, I was moving back to Watsika from New York City. I needed a place to live. I was 40 years old. I was like, 36. And I thought I could either live with my parents or move into a haunted house that needed a total gut renovation.
So you chose the haunted house.
I did.
Over living with mom and dad.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me more about your thoughts on just the different theories that have been passed on. As we mentioned, this got national attention. At one point, there were even newspapers debating how exactly things went down.
And that's exactly the point, right? There was a debate. When I lived in New York City, I met a doctor of philosophy on Long Island who was a professor of philosophy. And he wrote about the Watsika Wonder story in his doctoral thesis because he said that the spiritualists at the time were presenting this case not as like some local ghost story, but because they were presenting what they believed was evidence for their view of the world, of what the nature of the world is, that there's this thin veil between these two worlds, between our world and some intangible world beyond us, and that we can pierce that veil through the practice of spiritualism.
So, Dennis, this is all true?
This is all reported. All of these things have been reported.
Are we still
reported.
Saying allegedly?
Well, of course, 21st century people are skeptical, but so were 19th century people. There were skeptics about this story, but some of the evidence, first of all, she recognizes people she hasn't met. At one point, she describes, so the Venom girl is the body. The Roth girl's spirit is in that body. And she, the body, describes living in Texas, seeing the Red River, seeing indigenous people in Texas. The Venom girl had never been there. The Roth girl had lived there years prior. She finds a lace collar. This is all in this article, this contemporaneous article. She finds a lace collar in a drawer she's living in the Roth house. It's the Venom body living in the Roth house. She finds a lace collar and says, oh, this is my favorite collar that I've always enjoyed wearing. So much of this is very compelling. Is it true? It's very compelling.
Dun, dun, dun. Neil, we've talked a little bit about Winchester Stevens, the spiritualist from back then. Help us understand that role, right? They're experts when it comes to the afterlife and the spirit world. What else should we know?
All right. Well, first, just so everybody knows, there's no such things as experts in this field. There isn't, okay?
Okay.
There isn't. There's only very good researchers who learn from trends in haunted locations. Anybody who tells you they're an expert at this, they're lying to you. You start to learn from a certain location, hey, this type of haunting's going on, and now I've been called to this haunting. Well, now all of a sudden I'm starting to get the same thing. So maybe now I have an intelligent haunting that's going on here because I notice the same kind of interaction going on. Or a residual haunting, which is a playback through time that does not interact with people. So maybe that's how that works. So with Dr. Winchester Stevens, he, he, I, I don't think there's such thing as experts, but people are going to, everybody comes to their own conclusion,
right.
If that helps them, is that they're going to come to their own conclusion about it. And in the end, he believed that, you know, this thing was really, really going on.
Right.
And the more I researched it, I really do believe that this happened. And like I was telling you, it's more of a spiritual miracle because we had our first girl, Mary Roth, okay? She was admitted into this asylum where they're in, supposedly she died in the asylum. What happens, any parent would love to know if they can get forgiveness for the actions that took place. So if all of a sudden a parent can get a second chance at being able to say goodbye one more time, wouldn't you do that?
Mm. Well, you know, there is some interest in things like that, John. I know that you've got the house on Airbnb these days, and people host seances.
Yeah, people use it for family reunions, for seances, for ghost hunting, anything and everything.
Have there been any sightings in the 20 years that you've
not
been
so
the
much
owner?
Sightings, but recordings are weird at the house. So, like, if you just want to have a relaxing week at the house, don't record yourself.
you gotta explain.
Audio seems to work well at the house, right? To record it, listen back to it. You might hear voices on it. It's super weird. Yeah.
Interesting. Dennis, let's get more into the structures here, right? These two houses, what did they look like back then versus now?
Very much as they do today. That's one of the remarkable things, is these two houses that figure into this story look pretty much as they did. The one, the Venom house, is the one that's a mile south of the other. It's where the girl grew up. Unfortunately, we aren't able to talk to the owner. I called multiple times. He's not interested. But it's sort of a standard small town wood frame house, milk carton shaped, with a wing off it. And it's south of the main street in Watsika.
Mm-hmm.
And then north of the main street is this brick Italianate house, the one that John owns, the one where the Roth family lived. It's had a couple of additions since that time, but it was, you know, straight-sided brick house with a steep roof, arched windows, big curving, big handsome staircase going up from the first floor, and apparently had a view sort of down the street, not all the way to the other house, but she could sit in her bedroom window and look out toward the house she had come from and the house she would return to 110 days later.
Was it important to you, John, to preserve that original look and feel of the home?
Yeah, it needed a gut renovation when I bought it, and I wanted to put it back the way it was so people could experience history, experience what it was like for Victorian in the 1860s, 1870s in rural Illinois, returned it to its original color scheme, worked with the last plaster in Watsika to replaster all the walls and put it back the way it was.
Mm. What's Graveside Paranormal's relationship with the Roth House today, Neil?
Oh, it's very good. We just did last year, I think that we had on October 26th last year, we had over 150 people out for a seance on the grounds.
150 people.
Yeah, which me and Larry Eisler, my buddy, we filmed it. It's going to be going out in film festival.
So what do? Just put out flyers up in the neighborhood?
Yeah,
this is coming up.
Man. Come on out, man.
People just show up.
Bring your cat.
Sell tickets on Eventbrite.
Yeah. Well, no, that's what we do. We actually do. We do. We do. We sell tickets on Eventbrite. Everything I do, I use the Eventbrite. I love Eventbrite, by the way. Is that small plug? Sorry.
We are not sponsored by Eventbrite.
We are not. Right. But yeah, I used that, and we had over 150 people out there, and I had Diet Renee, international media, and Diet Renee, my very good friend. We conducted the seance. And what it is for just so people understand what a seance really is, at least to me, people have a lot of baggage in life, okay? It's through spiritualism. And sometimes, like we were talking about the original story of Asa Roth and his wife Dorothy and Mary Roth, could they have gotten forgiveness for 100 days of being able to say goodbye to their daughter? If we can give that to somebody, that same kind of a feeling, and I have the medium there where she's able to do what she does with her psychic abilities, and in the end, I make you feel good, then I think we're doing something positive for a lot of people.
What do you say to, and I'd love to hear from you both on this, the people who are just skeptical of all this and they just think this is nuts? You first, John.
I mean, I bought the house as an agnostic. I'm still skeptical of certain things. I see myself more as an observer, and I respect the people coming looking for answers and respect the way that they go about it and respect the people who don't believe.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Neil? I mean, is it an educational moment, or is it just a, okay, you're entitled to feel the way you feel?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I think everything that has to deal with the paranormal, the supernatural, it's educational. Like I just took a group of people out the other day, and part of what we do on our ghost tours that we do on the South Side is I try to educate people. I actually give you out equipment during the night and we do things, but it's also that people are curious. All people have a natural curiosity for these things. And so they're going to learn. And then maybe all of a sudden they'll touch into something that's in them. And maybe, once again, a lot of my things that I want to talk about is positivity when I do these things.
Right.
And the end result, I want to make sure you had a good time. And I want to make sure you walked away with that positive attitude. So I would say definitely learning process, but as well as the spiritual process as well.
Yeah, Dennis, I think the positive spin to this story is quite fascinating. I didn't expect that, I've got to say.
Isn't it? It's fascinating to think of a haunting that has a happy ending. Mm-hmm. And it plays right into, I think John could market the house that way. He said people come for family reunions. Well, the first family reunion there was pretty dramatic.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And speaking of the drama, there is something that folks really just kind of fall in love with when it comes to this story as far as the details, right? Those 110 days, that's a long time for someone to be possessed by another spirit. What else do we know about what it was like just during that time for the two families?
You know, there's a fascinating moment in this original article where she's been living in the other house. The Venom girl has been living in the Roth house for nearly 110 days. And the Venom mom passes by, and the Roth dad writes in a letter to somebody, "I really feel bad for her. I feel bad that her daughter is gone from her home. But on the other hand, her daughter is in such a better condition now."
Yeah.
So everybody, it seems as if at least the spiritualist family, the Roths, they felt as if this was sort of a task that needed to be accomplished. We don't have much about the emotions of the Venoms, but they did get their daughter back after 110 days.
Incredible.
And she wasn't as tormented as she had been.
For now, I'll just keep my head in the material that you all have shared with me here, because I'm just going down a rabbit hole with this story. We'll leave it here for now. Dennis Rodkin is with Crane Chicago Business. We've got John Whitman Brito, who's the current owner of the Roth House, and Neil Gibbons, who's founder of Graveside Paranormal Haunted Ghost Tours. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
Okay, now it's time to catch you up on the big stories of the day. We checked in with WBEZ news anchors Claire Lane and Michael Puente, and Violet Miller, a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. I want to start with you, Mike, because I know that you've got an update on a story that you covered. This was about a father who was arrested by ICE less than a day after his daughter returned home from Lurie Children's Hospital. She was getting treatment for an aggressive form of cancer. What's their story?
Yeah, this happened about almost a week and a half ago. It was on a Saturday. Ruben Torres Maldonado, he was at a Home Depot in suburban Niles, and that's where federal agents arrested him, detained him. Actually broke his window to his car, got him out of his car. And this is a man who, yes, he has been here in the United States since 2003, but he's never had a removal order. And a judge on Friday says he was detained, his rights were violated, that he needed a hearing before that. So he's ordered immigration officials to give him a hearing before the 31st. That'll be Friday. So, yeah, they said that he his rights were violated.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, though, that in a statement, Border Patrol Assistant Secretary Trisha McLaughlin said she's cited as his criminal history as speeding tickets. Now, we've all gotten speeding tickets. So if that's a criminal history, that's not much of a criminal history. So he should be having a hearing sometime this week. We'll see if he gets that. Otherwise, it'd be interesting to see if he's released. And yes, his daughter, 16-year-old daughter, suffering from a rare form and aggressive form of cancer. She's been treated at Lurie. She was there for like more than a month, was released a week ago from last Friday.
Yeah, just the range of emotions that family's been through.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just got a chance to see her and the mother at a press conference a week ago. And yeah, it's an emotional story.
Yeah. The trial of Sean Grayson, this is that former cop who shot and killed Springfield area resident Sonia Massey. That continues this week. It had a dramatic start last week, Mike. Remind us what happened.
Well, yeah, it started because there was a pathologist who testified that had, so obviously we know that Sean Grayson, it's been on the video, you know, they went into her apartment and there was some kind of situation, but that there was a boiling pot of water that caused all this for Grayson to shoot at Sonia Massey. And her cousin, Sante Massey, said that a pathologist said, had they gotten to her earlier, they could have stopped the bleeding.
Yeah, so she made a call. It was a mental health call. They showed up. She went to the kitchen at one point after talking to them at length from her couch in a calm exchange, so it seems, from the body cam footage.
Right.
She went to the kitchen at one point and went to get remove a boiling pot of water from the stove. And from Grayson's point of view, he said he saw that as a threat, though she was moving.
That's
the pot.
Right. And Sante Massey, a cousin of hers, just said it's heartbreaking because to know that she could have survived this and this all happened. So the trial is expected to perhaps wrap up this week.
Hmm. Let's stay in Springfield, Claire. The fall veto session resumes tomorrow, and mass transit funding is definitely top of mind for Governor Pritzker. The Regional Transit Authority says without more state funding, it's going to have to make severe cuts, service cuts, and possibly lay off workers. So do we have a deal yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
This is the last half of the fall veto session, resuming tomorrow and extending through Thursday. So Governor J.B. Pritzker has been very adamant about transit being a priority, that he wants to bring finally an end to the state's mass transit funding problem, the saga, whatever you want to call it. He wants to get this wrapped up. And as you just mentioned, without more state funding, the RTA is saying it's going to have to make service cuts, potentially lay off some workers. So the agency is projecting $230 million. That's the shortfall in 2026. And also saying that that could quadruple, right, by 2028 if the state doesn't step up. So the RTA, which oversees three transit agencies, we should remind folks, train and bus service, could be cut up to 40%.
Wow, that's a
lot. Is what they're saying if the state doesn't indeed come through with some of this funding. Pritzker is saying talks are continuing on a funding deal. He expressed some optimism that an agreement could be reached by Thursday. But essentially what's still on the table is last May, lawmakers in the state Senate passed a bill that would raise $1.5 billion a yearly funding for transit through an online sales delivery tax. So that bill was never called to the House. Some lawmakers are saying that they've worked through the summer to amend this bill, making it more appetizing potentially. So that's what's still on the table. We'll have to watch tomorrow and Wednesday in Springfield to see what kind of amendments were made to that bill.
Got a lot to discuss for sure.
More money on the table.
Yeah. Closer to home, Violet, some Northwest Side residents woke up to federal agents, tear gas, and whistles Saturday morning. What happened?
Yeah, so it was actually two separate parts of the old Irving Park neighborhood. On Saturday, the 3700 block of North Kildare Avenue, as well as the intersection of Roscoe and Harding. On Kildare, they had been set for a Halloween parade that never set off, with children in costumes. That sort of thing was routed right down the street where federal agents detained three people, a construction worker they had been chasing from around the block, as well as a 70-year-old neighbor who was just trying to get home, and a bike responder per residents who I spoke to yesterday who witnessed everything. Apparently, the construction worker, per Alderwoman Ruth Cruz, has been here since he was 4 years old. So, you know, by all accounts, she said this is his home. But they join, you know, a growing number of, you know, neighborhoods that have seen tear gas deployed as residents kind of came out to, you know, face off against agents who were taking their neighbors or taking somebody from their neighborhood, coming out to film and shout and getting chemical munitions in response. I mean, just in the last 3 weeks, we've seen Lakeview, Little Village more than once, East Side, Albany Park, Brighton Park, and Logan Square all tear gassed. And that is all just since October 3rd.
Yeah. And U.S. Customs and Border Patrol Commander at Large Gregory Bovino is set to appear in court this week, Violet. He's got to answer some questions about his use of force and tear gas against protesters in Little Village. I mean, how is the federal government going to defend these actions? What have they said so far?
They're probably going to be running the same kind of defense that they have been. They've been calling these people agitators. They've been saying that people are throwing things and that is their justification. But per Brian Culp, a resident and former Cook County prosecutor who was there Saturday when the tear gas was deployed, he said, quote, "These weren't activists. These weren't paid protesters. These were literally my neighbors coming out of their homes at 10 o'clock in the morning because they saw lawless agents acting in violent ways." And so that's been kind of the general response to the government's defense. But of course, depositions are slated to start on Wednesday, so we could see, a couple of hours of Bovino talking. However, the federal government moved recently to make that inaccessible. They don't want Bovino's depositions to be public or accessible to the public.
Claire, the Ravens beat the Bears.
Yeah,
snapping a 4-game winning streak.
Right, and Mike can attest to this. It wasn't that exciting of a game. We've been as sort of on an uphill a battle wanting the Bears to continue to get this done. And that 4-game win streak, it was sweet, but then they lost 30-16 yesterday. I mean, they had put together sort of that run, right, since 2018, but they have been doing it by really strong fourth quarters, forcing turnovers, you know, running really sound plays, which is all part of Ben Johnson's offense. But none of that, none of that happened yesterday.
Yeah, he was giving credit too where it was due to the Ravens.
Certainly. I mean, he also just said the Bears need to play a clean game. And they gave up quite a few penalties, let alone many in that fourth quarter, which he's calling unclean. Well,
did you watch, Mike?
I did watch some of it. And the most concerning part of the whole thing is just it's a second game in a row, just a poor performance by Caleb Williams. I don't know what's going on there. Maybe just too much pressure, too much, with Ben Johnson, just too much changes. I think they should bench him for one game, not as a punitive, but for him to step back and learn a little bit, see the game slower on the sidelines, he might benefit from that.
Interesting take from Mike
Paget. Paget Bajan can come in and just slow it down. Again, not punitive because, people might be saying, no, you can't bench him. He has to learn. But last two games, he hasn't played good. And they should have won yesterday. There was no Lamar Jackson in there.
Yeah.
And they lost to a third string quarterback. So there's really no excuse for it.
What else are you watching, Claire, other than sports?
Well, we're watching a few things, but it's one of those unique times where we have all the sports right now. There's still baseball, World Series, Game 3 tonight. We got Bulls playing tonight. Hawks played yesterday. Chicago Fire are still playing.
Yeah, but go Jays, go.
World Series has been more exciting than the Bears, to say the least.
Yeah, I agree with the Jays.
I didn't want to be the one to say it. Thank you, Claire.
But other stories we're watching here in Chicago, as we're mentioning, a lot of this immigration enforcement being tied up in courts, right? So we're seeing more signs that are banning federal immigration agents from entering private businesses popping up in and around Chicago. I'm sure Violet has seen this covering this on this weekend. Mayor Brandon Johnson, Alderperson Julio Ramirez were handing out signs on Friday. And this is all sort of to continue to back Johnson's executive order that he signed earlier this month, banning agents from setting up staging sites on city-owned property.
Right.
But, part of why this matters is because the city has told the Sun-Times on several occasions that these signs need to be posted. They need to be clear in advance of any raids or any staging for that executive order to actually be enforced. So something that we're continuing
to see. So now we're seeing them pop up. Interesting. Let's turn back to here to immigration enforcement, Mike, because I know there was a shadow hearing that was held by members of Congress on Friday. We heard some pretty personal stories from folks who were impacted by ICE and ICE arrests, didn't we?
Yes, we did. I mean, a shadow hearing basically just means it's unofficial. The government is shut down, but they still had this hearing. And at it, a number of people came up to testify how the enforcement is impacting them, including the Reverend David Black. He says he was shot with a pepper ball at a demonstration at the Broadview Immigration and Customs Enforcement Facility. You know, he's part of a lawsuit challenging the way federal agents have been using these tactics against protesters and journalists. And at the press conference, he called himself a pastor, that he's not a political activist. So it's just in the scene, you know, having this shadow hearing, but just the ongoing impact to Chicago. The spin from the White House is trying to make Chicago safe, but all it's doing is causing fear and anger. Mm-hmm. And how do you not expect residents to rise up and push back against this when you see agents coming into your neighborhood?
Yeah.
We know it's not about making the city safer. That's just impossible.
I mean, and this goes back to what you were talking about earlier, Violet, right? That is what we're seeing across the streets. Residents pushing back, but ICE coming with more and more chemical ammunition, et cetera. Before you go, as we all try to follow this bouncing ball, the pace of events is just so quick. What do you suggest that we keep an eye on, Violet, in the coming days when it comes to ICE? Because this problem is not going away.
I think a lot of folks are going to be turning to their local rapid response groups. A lot of, you know, older people's offices have already set up these connections with them where people can get whistles and supplies and things like that. So I think that general response is something to keep watching as this just continues to happen. But of course, you know, as Mike mentioned, the lawsuit, we've got Lovey and Lovey representing both journalists and protesters. But there are a number of accusations against them in addition to the chemical munitions. I mean, they are now accusing an agent of pointing a gun at somebody and saying, bang, bang, you're dead, liberal. That's part of court documents that were pulled yesterday. So anybody trying to keep up with that can follow our colleague John Seidel on Blue Sky. He's been absolutely on top of
stellar
all of this.
Reporting,
so everything
John.
Out of the federal courts, he's going to have it the minute it comes out.
Yeah, Mike?
Well, Sasha, I will say the one thing I'm going to be looking for this week, of course, you have the hearing with Bovino this week and then the depositions. I would keep my eye on the courts and specifically this Judge Sarah Ellis.
Yeah, oh,
because she has a short fuse.
She's been fed up.
And it won't be long until you see her coming up in the crosshairs with President Trump, because I think she's really challenging the government into justify that they are treating the neighborhoods and American citizens. She warned ICE that they have to give people warnings before they do this pepper spray and the tear gas. And we've seen in the video nothing like that. Bovino himself threw one of those canisters.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem like he was under any threat. He just did it. So we'll see what happens with Judge Sarah Ellis.
Yeah. This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sasha Ann Simons, and edited by Ethan Schwab. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, just head to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.